Good evening, my name is David, I'm an alcoholic. And I'll just tell you that my heart didn't start going, you know, my heart rate didn't go up until just about 2 minutes ago. And then it did. But my name is David and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a real alcoholic. I'm described in this book, all through this book, at varying stages of my disease, prior to my active disease, I am described many times in this book at different levels and different times in my life. And anything I say here, you can't hold against me. And if it has to do with my what it was like portion, I'm different now. Yeah. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. I know in my heart of hearts that I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows, and that that I suffer from an allergy to alcohol. That once I ingest alcohol, that all bets are off, and that there are no rules anymore. And I proved that in my drinking career. And then I talked about in there, the most frightening part of this after I got here was when it said bodily and mentally different from my fellows, and that we merely think that not drinking is, you know, that I'm paraphrasing, that just not drinking isn't enough, that we had to get down to the causes and conditions, because I certainly thought that if I just didn't drink, that things were going to get better. And the fact of the matter is that when I did not drink, things got better. But they just didn't stay that way. Yeah. They just didn't stay that way until I addressed what this program is all about. And it's about identifying who I am and who I'm not, who God is, who He's not. Applying the principles of this program that are instilled in the steps to my daily life. And I've been here long enough and practiced this program long enough that I'm learning to do that much, much better nowadays. Only thing I've done since I got sober perfectly was not drink no matter what. Everything else in my life since I got sober has been of the experimental variety. And I perpetrated sober many actions and many situations around me that were not positive in nature, and had to live and deal with the consequences and face the reality that sober, I still had the ability to harm those I love. Yeah. But anyway, you know, what it was like was I was raised by alcoholics. I guess I should call them alcoholics. Some events have happened recently in my life, one major event that has enlightened me and given me a new pair of glasses, a new way to look at my life when I was young, and when I lived with my mother and my father and my stepdad. And I guess I should just say that they drank a lot. They drank a lot. It was a priority in the household. It ranked right up there, if not before food. Yeah. And on the kitchen counter, there was always a gallon of something. Yeah. And so I'll just tell this story. My mother passed away last month on the 7th. It was just a wonderful, wonderful event. It might be weird, but it was. It was the culmination of her life and the gifts that she had given her children. And all of us had scattered our own ways, and during this process, we were all brought back together in one place, and were able to walk with her through her final days. And then there was the process of sorting through stuff, you know, her personal effects and things, and found little mementos of hers, of her life, you know. And my mother was abandoned when she was a child, you know, dropped off at the grandparents' house and left. And I never knew where my mother's faith came from, but I know it saved my ass. Here she was standing with it, and I knew my grandparents, and they were, you know, real loving people. At a young age, I think she was 16 or 17, and we found her Bible, and we found her some notes, an article she had written for, I believe it was either a school paper, some kind of paper, she had written a note about her faith in God. And my mother lived with that faith through her entire life, and her life was not easy. And I truly mean that, yeah, I believe it was her prayers that kept me alive and going long enough to get here. But they were drunks as well. The new pair of glasses. I used to think, one time I'll tell a story about, we moved like 26 times in 8 years after my mother married my stepfather. We just moved. Like every 2 months we were moving somewhere. Sometimes across town, sometimes across, halfway across the country. Just, you know, whatever needed to be done. And one time we landed in Chico, and we were broke, of course. And my father taught us how to find a home when you didn't have one. And you drive around town till you find the empty house that looks the worst. And then you go to the county courthouse and you find out who owns that sucker. And you go to them and you make a deal, that, you know, because you'll let us move in there. And we had, you know, the 3-4 kids and the old beat up car. And you would drive up to their house, and they would feel sorry for us and let us move into that little house, and we would, you know, make the deal, we're going to paint this house, you know. And so we landed in Chico, and we did that. We had, in those days, you could actually get the utilities turned on without a deposit, you know. You just went in there and did it, and it turned on. So we had electricity and gas, but we didn't have no money yet. And so we went doing, one of the things is, we can do it in the valley here a lot, you drive around until you find food. Yeah? And up there we were driving around, and it was late in the afternoon, and the only thing we could find was, there was a field there that we found, and it had some mustard greens in it. And so we took our little paper bags of kids and went out and picked mustard greens, you know. And we were driving a little farther, and there was an apple tree, so we got ourselves a few apples. And they had black walnuts all over Chico. I don't know if they still do, but they did then. Hard to catch the break to open up, but you could get them out if you tried hard enough. And that's what we had for dinner. You know? And I realize now that they were just trying to show us how food is, you know. And you know, yeah, that's the new pair of glasses that she gave me. You know, the whole thing has changed. So. And it's because I saw my mother's undying faith in her God. You know, that she carried with her and lived with through everything that went on in her life. And I left home when I was, I started experimenting, of course, when I was about 12, something like that. I had lots of cousins, and most of them were criminals. And but anyway, started drinking, dabbling, whatnot. It was the 60s, and we were actually living over in the San Francisco Bay Area at that point in time. So a lot of things were going on, you know. And I was actually raised by alcoholics. My real father was just a mean and nasty man, just a drunk, angry drunk. And I was never going to be a drunk. I was not going to be a drunk like them. And as the 60s goes, doing other things. But I was always drinking. I always had the beer with it, you know. I always had I always drank the wine, the Colt 45, whatever it was. But I wasn't drunk, not like them. And we wound up in Visalia. I was 17 and a half, last quarter of my senior year. And they decided they were leaving again. And I just was done. And I had a family here in town, an aunt, a great aunt. And I made a deal with her. I stayed with her until I graduated from high school, got my diploma. And then went for a manpower training program for diesel mechanics. That was my goal, to be a diesel mechanic. And started this manpower program, and there I met some people that were going to affect my life for many years to come. and one of them is now today, probably my oldest and dearest friend. And but we embarked on it. He was a fellow born in Dinova but raised in Mexico. And so he had some things going on down there, and his dad had a fishmeal factory on Sierra Cortez down on the west coast of Mexico. And so we began a little journey into illicit drugs, and that carried on for about 8 years, and life was just wonderful. Yeah. There was speedboats, and there was motorcycles, and there was sailboats in San Francisco, and 3 houses in 3 different places, and it was just a matter of going from place to place. We had everything I wanted, and just fun, fun, fun. And then one day, a friend of mine, his daughter died. And his daughter died from an overdose. And I felt like that maybe I played a part in that. And so I quit. And I quit all that fun stuff. But by then, there's a word in here, another word in here that really got my attention when I got here and read it and heard it the first time, and it's called the rapacious creditor. And so I quit that running around and was going to live the good life, and I had a girlfriend, we had some kids, and just going to straighten up and do it right. And when I quit, the only thing I had left out of it by the time all was said and done was a real bad habit. Real bad habit. And that habit took everything else there was left. That relationship, every dollar that I had, and my health. And it didn't leave me for years, but the process of the of freeing myself from that habit to another habit, alcohol was readily available, free and accepted, and so I just started drinking more. And then before long, I had become well acquainted in the dictionary. The actual definition of an alcoholic is one who is addicted to alcohol. And by the time all was said and done, after my 20-year run with everything that I was doing, I was the true dictionary definition of an alcoholic. I could not drink. Yeah. And by that time, I had nothing left. There were a couple of marriages, many jobs. Certainly my health wasn't any better. The only people that really wanted me were the police. But the end of it, the very tail end of it, was towards the tail end of it, 4 years before I finally quit. I had gotten drunk, riding a motorcycle, and took it down, and wound up on my mom and dad's couch, you know, waiting to heal up. And so I learned to walk again, and I did learn how to walk, because the liquor store was about a mile down the road, and when they quit giving me the pain pills, I walked down there, and I'd make it to the liquor store, and that lasted for a while, then one day my dad, man loved me to death and taught me so much that I use today that I just didn't give him enough credit for. Yeah. We argued one time about me coming home from school and learning how to work on washers and dryers. I don't want to work on washers and dryers. How come I have to do that? And he said, because you can go anywhere and you can get a job working on washers and dryers, because if they don't got one, they want one. That caused a big rift for about a year between me and him when I was 16, 17, 18 years old, and somewhere around in there. And I utilized that skill for the rest of my life. it actually got me into the position that I'm in today. But one day, after I laid on their couch, I think it was probably 6-8 months, I'd learned how to walk again. My knee was okay again, my hip was okay, and I could get around. And so by then I was drinking again. And I'll just tell you what he told me. He one day, he said, "Hey Dave, I need you to go for a drive with me. Let's go for a ride with me." "Okay, Dad." So we get in the car, and we live in Visalia, and he drives and drives out towards Calera here, and he's trying to talk serious shit, you know, trying to talk about real stuff, you know. "Hey, you're a wonderful guy, Dave, you know. You know, I love you." "Oh, shit, you know, something cool about you." And he explained to me that, he said, "David, you're like a time bomb. You're a wonderful person. You do so good. Even when you're drinking, most of the time, you do so good. It's just like living with a time bomb. We never know when you're going to go off. You know? And everything just falls apart." And we continued on, and he got just passed largely out there. And pulled the car over the stop sign, and he says, "And Dave, this is where you're going to get out. And you can't come home no more." And he said to me, "I won't have you doing that to my wife anymore." And he meant it. You know, he meant it. And that man did not was not in my presence for the next 8 years. He did not and would not be in my presence for about 2 years and 3 months after I got sober. He finally came to believe that I might stay sober and allow me to be in his presence again. And so I wandered around, and he actually knew what he was doing, because he was building houses, and there was a subdivision over there where he was building some houses, and they were kind of parked for a while. And he knew that's where I would go. And so I went and camped in one of the houses we were building. What the heck? Gotta stay somewhere. And it wasn't finished, had no plumbing, no electricity or nothing, but it was shelter. And as time went by, whatever I did then, I don't know. I'm sure I drank, and I know I had ways to drink, and I always had a hustle of some kind. But I wound up east of Visalia out on 198 looking for work. And there was a secondhand furniture store out there. And I walked into it, and there was this old man sitting there, the dad. And so I started chit-chatting with him and telling him what my plan was, that I'd make him some money to let me work on his washers and dryers. I did not know at the time that he actually knew my dad. But he was an old retired Nazarene minister, and then kept me alive for the next 4 years. He allowed me to sleep, and there was an abandoned pump house behind the store, and he allowed me to sleep out there on this little wood rack. And every once in a while, if I was really good and being consistent, I could come in the store at night, take my own room. And he learned my ways, and as time went by, he realized that when I made money, I didn't come back, you know. And so we made a deal that he would just give me $5 in the morning, you know, that he'd give me a pack of cigarettes at half punch. And then at noon, he'd give me another $5, and I'd get me another half pint and a pack of cigarettes, whatever. And then at night, he'd give me $10. And I'd get a pint and 2 bone brow darts. And I was in, you know. There was a little refrigerator back there, had sandwich stuff in it, you know. But the time bomb, the bomb kept going off every once in a while, you know. Every so often, the bomb would just go off. And everything would fall apart. Everything would fall apart. I was going to bring it to you, because I have a picture of the last time I was arrested, of my mugshot. when, by then I had got good enough friends with people that do that in jail, that, you know, when the trustees, that I knew him from being in jail, and I talked to him out of the little strip, because I was too drunk to get my hair right, left, you know. And so he kept having to retake them, so he got it right. And so I talked to him out of one of them, and I blew it up into a 8.5 by 11. And keep it on my office wall. I don't invite just anybody into my office. good picture. Reminds me. But this old retired Nazarene minister, and he allowed me to do that. And there were, and through the next 4 years while I was interacting with him, there were many times that we had many talks, you know, that he did his very best to explain to me, in a spiritual way, how I might solve my problem. And during that time, I had decided that I was going to, I needed a driver's license. Yeah, I have a driver's license. I haven't had one in years. But I was going to go to this drunk driving school. So I started going to this drunk driving school, and I just couldn't pull it off right, you know, because it was like in the afternoon, yeah. And you're not supposed to go drinking. And then I had important stuff going on, you know, but I'd not always miss. And they would throw me out of drunk driving school, and I'd have to go back to court and go reapply and start over. You know, I'm going to this, I don't know, 6-8 month drunk driving school, and 2.5 years down the road, and I'm still going. And it got so pathetic that she actually gave me permission to write my own excuses. I couldn't pull it off. And then one day, and actually the progression of the disease was continuing on, and I had gotten thrown out of drunk driving school one more time, and I had to this time, it was because of the judge in Dinuba. And he didn't like me anyway. So I had to go over there. And I had been there many times. And the last time I had been there, bailiff, when I got done with the judge, I walked over to get my paperwork signed, and the bailiff just looked at me and said, "I don't believe it." He said, "If you ever come in here smelling like that again," he said, "I'm going to send you right back up in front of the judge." And I knew. So if they throw me out of driving school, I'm going to have to go back to Dinuba to go to this thing. My court thing's at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. What am I going to do? I'm an alcoholic. I cannot not drink. So I catch the bus and I go to Dinuba and I don't drink. And I don't drink. And I'm just a basket. You know, I'm starting to quiver and feel sick. And I go through my court thing and he says, "Now I want you to go back to that drunk driving school and I want you to reapply for this thing so today." So I catch the bus back and then I have to walk from the bus station to the thing over on Caldwell, and by that time it's hot, I'm sick, and by that time that man at the liquor store that had been seeing me for years, from the time I was hobbling down with my bad leg till now, had been selling me alcohol almost on a daily basis. And it was like where I had the credit account if I got really tight. But by this time, the man is not selling me, he's selling me the alcohol. But by this time, with my night purchase, he's giving me TV dinners. He's trying to give me some food, trying to keep me alive. And I was down 137 pounds, my hair was falling out, went with some malnutrition, and things weren't looking good. So here I am sitting in the drunk driving school office, and shaking, sick, looking like I'm about ready to die. And this lady, one of us, Debbie M., was running the place at the time, and I walk in, and I'm sitting there in the whole thing waiting, And finally she walks through the door, and she was just that look that of amazement that people give you sometimes. Sometimes it might be your mother or your wife or somebody else. How long are you going to freaking do this, you know? And then that's pretty much what she says. She says, aren't you done yet? Yeah. What's it going to take? Yeah. And she took me into her office and assigned me some more money and told me I had to go to extra meetings. I mean, heavy. I can't go to more meetings. I don't even have a driver's license. And she says, I'm going to get a shit walk. Yeah. And I'll go see Jerry. And luckily, this man named Jerry, one of us, had been my counselor all along. And he had this one line through all this time. When you get done, because he always told me, he says, David, when you get tired, or you get all that, I can get you some help, David. I can get you some help. And I said, well, I got some things to do. I got things going on. at this day, I had nothing going on out there. Yeah, there was nothing left. I had nothing left in here. And so I said, okay. And he just pushed it through and got me on the list, you know, on a waiting list. I'm in this room dying, shaking and quivering, and they're telling me, now go park yourself and call us every morning. We'll see if we can get to you. Yeah. And Mr. Ward, Art, he's passed now. He knew what was going on, so we made a deal, and he was only going to give me $10 a day, 5 in the morning and 5 in the evening, and where I could keep myself well enough to wait. And I waited about 2 weeks, and the pressure just got too much. Just got way too much. And I couldn't do it anymore. I didn't want to do it anymore. I wasn't going to play anymore. The game was over. So I stole that man's truck, and I loaded it up with his furniture, and I went to where I knew I could get what I wanted. And I sold that furniture, and I got what I wanted, and I thought it would be enough. I had OD'd 3 times in my life, and I figured I knew how to do it. So I bought everything necessary. And it didn't work. And next morning I find myself out there laying out in the middle of Cutler Park, about to get run over by a lawnmower. Yeah. And I look up, and there's the truck, and the door's open. And all my stuff all over the place. And luckily, one more time from previous experience, I knew the man that ran Cutler Park, because I had mowed that lawn many times myself. Yeah. And so I went over to the shack and asked if I could borrow his phone, and figured all I got to do now is call Art, and the police will be here, and everything is cool. Somebody will take care of me. And Art says, don't go anywhere. I'll be right there. Yeah, right. Yeah. Within 10, 15 minutes, Art pulls up. And this is an old man. And then, you know, Cutler Park on the back side there, it's a little hill coming down to where he sat down there from the river. And he's hobbling down this thing. I think he's going to fall over. And he's waving this thing in his hand. And he's saying, David, guess what? You'll never guess what. And then he gets down there and says, what? And I've been calling this place every day for a bed, right? And no luck. And he, guess what? I what? And he said, they got a bed for you. Yeah. And I said, well, I'll need to go by the shop and get my clothes and stuff. And he says, oh, no, they're in the car. They're in the car here. We'll take you right now. And that began not my first attempt at recovery, but that began, that was my desperate time in recovery. I had tried previously in 1980, And the bizarre part is that it's 1989 at this time, and 1980 I had gone into this facility to try and get sober, stayed 15 days, got healthy enough to leave, and left on this journey to go find God, because that's what they said you needed, to find God. So I was going to go find God. And so I got drunk on the way. And then in 1985, at the behest of this woman that I married and her family, and my family, a little intervention type thing, they suggested I go away for a while. and I went to a place called Keen Challenge. And I stayed there for 6 months. None of them were desperate, and because of my own making of my own choices, serious, they weren't. But this time I knew that I was going to die, and I knew that I wanted to die, and it was okay. I just didn't want to play the game anymore. So they dropped me off, and I'm filling out this form. The only question I remember on it was the question, and I know that this is when I made my decision. I just said, we've made a decision. And this is when I made my decision. I was filling out that form. And it said, are you willing to do it our way? And that's the only question I stopped on it. And I thought about it. Yeah, okay, I'll do it their way. No matter what they ask me to do, I'm going to do it. And that's just, we'll see what happens. If it don't work, I can figure it out later. So I checked in, and the same room, the same building that I left 10 years before. Same place. And this time, I found God right where I had left him. And that's how it began. At that point in time, my conception of life, my conception of love, my conception of people, my conception of God was so distorted and twisted that I could neither label it or define it properly. Time went by. I stayed there. I did everything to the best of my ability. As I said earlier, the only thing I've done perfectly is not drink. I did everything to the best of my ability. Within 90 days, I was in a relationship. And we actually stayed together, and she was involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we remained married for 5 years. So we got married in a couple of years, and we stayed married for a couple of years, and then we began the divorce. The good news is that we both stayed sober through it. And one of the reasons I firmly believe that is that she had this Nazi sponsor that hit me against the wall when we started in this relationship. She says, well, this is the way it works. And she says, I don't give a shit about you so much. She says, but I've been working with her for a while. She had a year more than me. And she said, you just cut her chances of staying sober about in half now. She says, so I think you ought to step up and go to a few extra meetings. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, there's a couple of meetings. Why don't you go to that one too? And we did. And we stepped it up, and we stayed close to the program. Unfortunately, the relationship did not work out. I don't think it was a mistake. It was all part of the great adventure of life. Because since I've been here, there have been many things that have been part of my adventure that helped me through the process of what it calls and talks about in this book of smashing all of our old ideas. Now, I got here in 30, 60, 90 days. I figured I had it down. I no longer was going to do that. I was going to do this. I was going to live like this. I was going to do that. Little did I know that that I still didn't have the coping skills and the mechanisms within me to be able to live in a design for living that works. I was still relying on old ideas and concepts about love and things that I had to process. And still have to process to a certain degree. But in the early days, it was tricky and hurtful at times to me and others. So we stayed married for 5 years, and it was my fifth birthday, when I grabbed a bag of clothes and walked out. And I went and stayed at my sponsor's house, and realized that And I, at that moment in time, at that very moment in time, I no longer believed in you. I no longer believed in this program. I thought, God, don't you hear the hand. I've been going to all these meetings. I've been doing all this stuff. I've been praying. And it's not working. I didn't drink. And that was because of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. The next morning, I got up from my sponsor's house and I went to a morning meeting at the Alana Club. And this man that I almost virtually did not know, he was more friends with my wife than he was with me. And I was in the meeting and I had shared a little bit about what was going on. And the meeting was over and he walked past me and I heard a clink clink on the table in front of me. And I looked, and it was a key with a little note on it. And it said, it had an address on there, and it says, the hallway, second door on the right. And I caught him outside, and we talked a little bit. And he said, yeah, he said, why don't you just take that room? And that was Mr. Boston Paul. And Boston Paul played the Eskimo in my life for the next probably 10 years of my experimentation and perpetration of my adventure on others. And I was desperate to get married again. And this time to someone that was new in recovery. And, yeah, it kind of was. Yeah, it was. It was a mistake. And it hurt. It was terrible. It was terrible for me and for her. And it lasted a couple of years. And finally, I survived it and got out of it. And that process of character building, I think I truly believe that sometimes the greatest leaps that I have made in recovery have been when things were the most painful and I was the most willing to surrender and let God. And when I realized the reality of the proof that my best thinking when I was using was deadly. My best thinking when I was sober was quite frightful. And hurtful to people. And again, smashing those old ideas, the reevaluation of what love is, what I am, what I'm not, what God is and what He's not, what He's going to do for me and what He's not. I took that last promise, page 83 and 84 of the big book, Last Promise, and I'd read it for years. Will suddenly realize that God will do for you what you cannot do for yourself. And I kept giving him lots of responsibility and things he was supposed to do and did not know that there were so many things that I was responsible to do for myself. And it's, all those events in my life truly are what have made my life and made me who I am today. I believe that they were not mistakes. I believe they were part of my adventure to help me and to facilitate the smashing of my old ideas. I just kept hanging on to concepts that I knew better, that surely this was going to work out, that must be God's will for me, because I want it. And it doesn't always work that way. And so time, goes by, and I didn't drink no matter what. And there were times when at 3 o'clock in the morning I'm rocking on the bed. Trying to make that decision. What am I going to do? I can't sleep. I can't eat. I can't do nothing. I'm just rock on this bed. And I rock on that bed. And then it's 5:30, 6 o'clock. The Lana Club will be open in a little while. And I go sit in a chair at the Lana Club. And not want to be there. Go there and not want to be there. But I'll just stay. Just glue my ass to that chair and stay. And it would pass. Someone would come and sit next to me. His old John T. He'd come and sit next to me on the bench. Yeah. And with just a few words, I would know I was safe again. There's someone with me. There's someone here that knows what I did, and they don't hate me. you know. And that's the way Alcoholics Anonymous has worked for me. I didn't drink no matter what, and I kept coming no matter what, and I read the book, and I did my best, my very best, and I lived through my mistakes. And it has given me the ability to today to make choices and decisions in my life based on real facts and not the things that are going on in my head. I've learned how to label my feelings and label my fears and know that I have them and know that they're God-given and that I don't have to be guilty. I don't have to feel shameful or guilty that I have fear. It's actually a healthy little thing. It causes me to search for the answer. And as I was saying when I first got here, that the secret is in the search. And as long as I'm looking for the right answer, and I'm looking in the right places, I will find it. As long as I'm not drunk, I can find it. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me in terms of my disease and getting to the point that today I live a wonderful and blessed life. Much better than I ever thought and better than I deserve. This has been an eventful few months for me. My mother was 81 years old, and about Christmas time, day before Christmas, she started having little events, and things started going downhill from there. And she finally passed on the 7th. So I'm self-employed, which is, quite a blessing for me, because I was able to take the time to be with her quite often, and most of my customers. I was able to be there. I chose to be there. I was able to be there, and I'm self-employed today. I have a home. I don't live in an abandoned well house. I have a God, a higher power that I believe in and trust. I don't understand them. I don't understand some of the things that go on. But I know that if I do the next indicated thing and apply the principles, that in the process of that, is that somewhere down the road, it will be revealed to me why I did what I did. That was taught to me one time when I was 5 years before Christmas birthday, my divorce. I'm in a meeting, I'm crying. This man, my boss had thrown me out of work, said, "You can't come around the machinery today, David. Go away." Yeah. So I went to the noon meeting. This is after the morning meeting. I went to the noon meeting, and there was a fellow sharing, and he got up, the meeting was over, and he got up and walked past me, and my mind just clicked. Wow, he just went through a divorce. About a year before, he had been sharing that he had gone through a divorce. So I followed him out the parking lot. He took me over to his shop and sat down and talked with me and said, "David, I can't change what you're going to feel. I can't change what you're going to have to go through." He says, "But I can tell you that in a year from now, you're going to understand." And all my mind is, "I can't do this in a year, you know." But in a year from then, I understood. And I knew the reason that was not a mistake. It was exactly what needed to happen for and to me so that I would be forced to do the introspective look into who I really am. And as I said today, that the events of my life, that passing of my mother, to be able to be there and walk with her, because I know that there were endless nights that she sat there and prayed for me when I was lost. I know that for a fact. And the gift of her faith is just astounding right now, that she actually went through all the things, she went through all the stuff, and carried that faith and lived with it and nurtured it all of her life. And to watch the culmination of on her deathbed, us as a family and siblings coming back together and joining and reuniting relationships that have long since dissipated into distance and lack of communication. And the things that are important in life. And I got to be there I'm the guy that never was around family events, funerals, birthdays, parties of any kind. I just didn't do that stuff. And also, I got married like 3 weeks ago. Yeah. There's a wonderful girl over there. And I can tell you for sure that that was not my plan. My sponsor told me straight up that my picker was broken and I best leave that alone. And then you read in the book here where it talks about perhaps some of us are better off being single. But Kathy and I have done quite well together, and we're really enjoying life together. And so I hope anybody that's new here anybody that's having difficult times, believe me, with my mom passing, there were times when during the beginning of the process and stuff that when I was not going to work, I was going to see her, and then I would leave her, and I would feel guilty for leaving her, and I would feel guilty for not working, and I would just back and forth and back and forth. What do I do? Where's the money going to come from for this? All this stuff. And the thing that carried me through was, I've never, ever, just like the man walking by me and throwing a key on the table that I barely even knew, I have never, my needs have always been met since I've been here. Everything. Not my wants, but my needs have been met. And I firmly believe in this power that when I got here, what he done for me, look at my life. So, if you're new or you're struggling with some hard times, difficult times, don't give up. Don't shrink. Keep coming to the meetings. Grab the book. Talk to somebody. Shake their hand. We're here. Just as those who've been here for me, we're all here for each other. I hope you give yourself a break. Because it wasn't until I surrendered and made that decision that I was able to start grasping and learning what this program has to offer. And it truly is a design for living that works. You never, ever have to drink again. And I did not understand that the first time somebody said that in a meeting. Because I could not drink. So, yeah.